You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Sarah Langan is the author of Good Neighbors, Audrey's Door, The Missing, and The Keeper. Her new novel is A Better World. Thank you for joining me, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. It's great to meet you.
You know, we can start with the title of the book, A Better World. The project of the 20th century was, you know, aimed at unity. You know, we had the League of Nations, we had the United Nations, and by the end of the 20th century, we did not have a unity. Here in the early 21st century, we have achieved global unity because everybody in the world seems to agree on one thing, that the world is going to hell. It does not matter what your political beliefs are, your religious conventions, it's all pretty obvious that it's headed downward fast. And I think that this novel really captures that feeling. And one of the things you do so well is to do just a tiny amount of world building in a way that really underpins the whole part of this book. And so tell us a little bit about how you've created The Day After Tomorrow with The Great Unwinding.
Well, thank you. I love that question, because that world building was hard. It was really hard. I went over and over and over again the first like 30 to 50 pages of the novel because I wanted it to be seamless. I wanted anyone picking it up to say, to be drawn in, as opposed to it being just a genre fiction. Like, I don't like when I have to learn rules. I like not realizing I've been learning rules. I like this idea of just like being drawn in by the plot and suddenly you realize you're in another world. And so that was much of the work of the story, was trying to make it as accessible as possible. But you know, to my mind, you know, I have a degree in toxicology, of also trying to have the foundations of the science there so that a reader who I'd been thinking about it, a genre reader, would still be rewarded. So there was that. But honestly, have you seen The Day After? It's so good. I love that movie. But it's this idea, the story is about, it's the near future, and it's things are just falling apart more than they have been. And what I'm seeing right now in the world is that people with the means are leaving. You know, they're scared, they're building walls, they're figuring out ways. Like, I've heard conversations about, like, where are you going to go for global warming? Are you going to go to the Great Lakes? What's the property you're going to buy? And I think when people make decisions like that, those decisions are often in their own best interest and the best interest of their children, but they're not in the best interest of society. And the problem with making decisions like that, these selfish decisions that are also smart, is they're dumb decisions because their children will be ultimately hurt by these decisions. They'll be hurt. They're sort of, instead of making your legacy spread over time, you're eating your legacy. So the story is a lot about that. It's about people who have these decisions that they have to make, but what do you do? And when do you draw the line and say, like, you know what? I refuse. I refuse to be a part of this.
You know, the way you describe that, I realize that the entire world is getting a reverse mortgage.
Yes.
Well,
that's exactly what it is. That is perfect.
And you know, one of the things I really loved about this book was that I think it really creates its own genre, which I would call its novel of suspenseful social unease. And you know, everybody's afraid of a lot of things. You might not want to have world full of the Walking Dead or global thermonuclear war. You don't want to get eaten by a giant shark. But what I'm really afraid of, to be honest, is finding myself in a situation where I don't know what the people around me are thinking or how I'm supposed to act. And you know, I'm afraid of being embarrassed. And another word for embarrassment is mortified. And you think that's like, you know, it's in a sense like being turned into the living dead.
Yeah. Mortified. Yeah, the world they enter has these different rules like that, where there's a secret, and it's a cultural secret. And when people have secrets, they behave differently, especially when they have collective secrets. I don't know. Like, I think health is really important. And I think what I'm seeing, and the reason, like, people are legitimately afraid right now because access to healthcare in some ways is better than it's ever been. And in some ways is really, really bad. And I think the haves have excellent healthcare, and I'm not as sure about the have-nots. And I think when you're sick or your loved one is sick, you'll say, sure, I'll deal with these kinds of people. I don't care what I have to do to make sure I can get by. I'll compromise most things.
You know, at the beginning of this book, too, it's also a wonderful story of suburbia, which I think is an undercovered institution in the world, in our world, because, you know, so many stories are set in big cities or in small towns, and suburbia is, there's a lot of it, and a lot of us have lived in it our entire lives. At the beginning of this book, you have a wonderful suburban family. It's a farmer, Bowen's mom and dad, and a girl and boy, and they're all living in outside what they consider outside of world, and things are unruly. The jobs are falling apart. Their lives are falling apart, and they get invited to live in this wonderful new city. It's a Plymouth, called Plymouth Valley. It's a company town. And I like this kind of design, a part of the design of your world, that things are kind of degrading into not so much different countries or under different political regimes, but different company towns. And that's a fascinating vision.
You know, I think Atwood did it. You know, I don't know if you read Orcs and Crake. I'm sure you did, mm-hmm. Right? She had that idea. But also, you know, I live in Los Angeles, and it just feels like this is just a one company town. And when I first got here, I was kind of shocked because people don't say what they think. And they especially, if they don't want to do something, they say, I'll check my schedule. They never just say no. You know, there's a lot of like coded language for disapproval. And, you know, even like when I pitched TV shows and stuff, you just never get a no. It's just when you know it's a no because you didn't get a yes. And it's people, they don't want to make enemies because there's only one way of making a living here. And you can't have someone dislike you if they get in a higher position than you and then badmouth you. Because I've also heard a lot of, like, there's a lot of badmouthing in this town. It's surprising to me. You know, you'll say somebody's name and go, everybody's, oh, you can't work with him. And I'm like, I don't know. Why would I believe you? Like, I should probably, but like, that's a weird, you know, you can't just take someone's word for it. But a lot of people do, because chatter. And I think there's a fear too. There's a lot of fear. It's a fear-based industry, especially because, you know, there's, as a creative, all I want to do is make things. It's all I care about. But then there's so much scaffolding around that. That's people who are putting their money in, and all they want is their money. And, you know, it's less important what I'm making, but that it makes money. And yeah, so it's there's a lot of LA in there. And there's a lot of, like, when I first moved here, like I have in the book that everyone like is like, thank you. And they're like always doing this. And like, I'd never seen that before. And like, I was from New York, you know, in Brooklyn. And I get here and people are like, I'm just, thank you for bringing the popcorn, you know? Like, are you praying right now? Like, who are you talking to? Am I like, are you, who is being worshiped right now? And I think they don't always know. And I think it's a form of self-worship. I do, you know?
You know, it's so interesting when you say that, when hearing you talk, because I realize how realistic this surrealistic book is. I never thought about it that way, but you know, yeah, LA is a one company town, and this kind of idea of coded communication is, I think, at the core of this book, because the family who moves in, and we get most of the stories told from the point of view of the mother, Linda, they move into this town. It's the golden ticket. I mean, it's more like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And you start to think, wow, this is like, you know, this entire world is based on like cartoon level thinking. And probably not a good sign.
Well, I was thinking a little bit of the lottery too, and a lot of like Shirley Jackson's summer people.
Yeah,
you know, that idea that of someone knows something.
I was just thinking about that. That this is a super Shirley Jackson-esque feel to it, and the lottery is the one I was thinking of, because behind all this civility, that when you go into some place like LA, and you meet a bunch of people and they're all happy and very friendly, even behind all the civility, you're thinking, they're going to kill me and eat me.
When I first moved here, like, you know, I was trying to make friends, and a lot of the moms like didn't want to be my friend, because I drove this old, I don't know, it was a Camry, something like that. And it was old, you know, and oh, it was the Chevy Malibu. And like, they all had Porsches, you know, it was the public school, but it's a nice public school. And one of the moms specifically asked me what kind of car I drove in front of other moms. And I think it's because they'd been talking about my Camry. And I was like, I drive a Camry. And they were like, we're all going to a pool party at so-and-so's house. Have fun. And I was like, man, that's like the meanest thing that's happened to me as a grown-up in a really long time. Like, and then another mom was like, what do you do for a living? And I was like, I'm a writer. And she's like, well, how do you make any money? It's like, I don't really, you know, and then it's like, well, my husband does this. It's a lot of my husband does this.
Wow, you know, the more I speak with you, the more I realize is that this isn't, I mean, this isn't science fiction. It's not satire. It's reality. And that's one of the things that's interesting about this book, too. It has a knife edge of being really terrifying, but also at the same time, it is very funny. Talk about, you know, right, using that edge of horror and humor, and, you know, it's like, you know, the Janus mask.
You know, I think it's how I see things. Like, I don't think anything is believable unless there's humor in it. And it's just maybe how it's how I live my life. But I think it's how most people feel emotions, is you need some sort of, you need a modulation. And if you don't have that, if it's just like fear, I think it gets exhausting and people get sick of reading it. You want that. You want these sort of building, and you want tension release. And I think that's what makes it feel realistic. Like Jordan Peele, like I totally get behind Get Out for that reason, because it's funny and it's more memorable. So that's what I work toward.
You know, this book, the family moves in, the Farmer Bones move in, and they're all pretty nervous because this is, you know, the golden ticket. The world outside is farther along its path to hell than it is now. Not much, because we're not that far. We're pretty close now. We're the binoculars, you can see the fires.
Yeah, I think so.
And so they're pretty happy to get there, and also pretty desperate to stay there. And what happens when they move into this new community is they're invited in, they're told this is a great honor, and then they're ostracized, frozen out. And I think the way that this happens and the way you convey this makes, you know, that a really kind of terrifying experience. You know, more so than being chased by people with knives is living in a world where everybody dismisses you.
I think it has the effect of wearing people down and wearing their relationships down. And so, I don't know, any time in your life or in my life that I've been excluded systematically, repeatedly, in a way that I haven't had relief from, I found my own personality bending in ways that wouldn't ordinarily. You know, you become more of a pleaser. You get more quiet. You're less likely to pass judgment. You're less likely to follow your own instincts. And I think that's, you know, if you're pledging a college fraternity, there's a breakdown before they build you up, or the military. And I think they're similar in that way of who's in charge, not you. You follow the rules. And when you're built back up and loyal, then you can have some power. And I think that's maybe how a lot of institutions work.
You know, this company, Town, as I was reading this novel, I was thinking of another book I read by Jeff Gwynn called The Road to Jonestown, which was an exhaustive biography of Jim Jones. And I was thinking, it was fascinating, terrifying. But as I was reading this book, I was thinking, boy, this is like Jonestown, where you, as you say, once you're worn down, you can learn to accept anything, even the smallest crumbs. And then once you have crossed that path, that line, you'll keep crossing it. And that's kind of what happens. Talk about, you know, and also the breakthroughs. There are some really fun parts in this novel where Linda gets in there into this city, into this town. It's called Plymouth Valley, and the company makes this universally used ingredient, a miracle plastic called Omnium. It's a miracle, yeah. And once she's there, she finds that she's not accepted up until one point she is. And I love the character of Danielle, and especially talk about creating this kind of like group of women who are both on the inside, but just a little bit on the outside, so that they can draw Linda in.
I wanted the notion of like, what is power for women in a system such as Plymouth Valley? And these women are, the first thing is a couple of them are outsiders too. They're first generation, which in Plymouth Valley, sort of the status of a person accrues over the amount of generations they've lived there. So they're outsiders, but outsiders also tend to do more things and get more done, because they have to prove themselves. And we have Daniela, and we have Meta Marie, and we have Rachel. And Rachel is, through her own work, on the board, and she's like a hotshot. And she's also married to one of the children of a founder. And Meta Marie is the grandchild of the founder. She's like royalty, she's like a princess, and she's pretty spoiled because of it. And then Daniela is married to the guy who's positioned to eventually take over Plymouth Valley. And she's gotten him there. And she is a siren, and she is a force of nature, and she's stunningly charismatic and gorgeous. And she has designs. She wants this town to be more than it is. They all do. And they want to make things better within the system. And so what they see in Linda is someone like them. And they're quiet about it, but they invite her in because they think that she can be one of them and she can help them change things because she's smart and she's hardworking and she's a doctor. And they want to open this clinic that takes care of children outside of Plymouth Valley, which is sort of new and also makes them feel like they're doing something and it eases their consciences. So there's this dynamic of the four of them, but they're also sort of recreating the power structure of the town. So they're following the rules at the same time.
You know, one of the things that makes a book fun is when an author is having fun, the reader also has more fun. And I can't tell you how much fun I had at your, the pamphlets, the drawings, yeah, all the little incidentals that you make up, because they just read so perfectly like the kind of corporate claptrap. But this corporation has teeth, as do the birds.
Yes. I loved doing the interstitials. They were so silly. And like I'm such a bad artist that I went on like Microsoft, you know, and did stock photos. But then I thought, you know, that's exactly what my character who does the pamphlets would do anyway. And she just like these rules, these endless rules that they have for the town that are subterfuge for other rules that they're not talking about. And then like just these silly, silly like guides to offerings and what you're supposed to put the where and how the kindergarten children, kids are supposed to, you know, celebrate Hollow. It was super fun.
Now that gets to one of the really interesting and fun parts of this book is that the central philosophy of this town is called Hollow, which is, you know, it's a real one. This book is great at the uh-oh moments when you read something and you go, uh-oh,
this can't be good.
So you must have had a lot of fun with those.
I did. Sometimes I'd be like, no, it's not too much. Like, it's fine. And the nuclear shelter, that was fun. That was fun to write about.
Well, I another interview I did with a fellow who interviewed all the people who had nuclear shelters built and the people who are building them for him. I mean, you really nailed it spot on, and it's frightening and oppressive. And I think one of the things I love is that, you know, you just tweak it just enough in the way you, one, as I thought when I was hearing these, reading about these interviews this guy did with the people who built the shelters, I think, oh my God, this is like one step away from a horror movie. You go that extra step. Thank you.
Well, you know, I have a friend, Jenny Perlin. I forgot the name of her movie, but it came out last year. It was a documentary about bomb shelters. And she went and met all these people who'd had bomb shelters made or who'd made them themselves, who'd sold everything. And they tended to be lonely men. That was it, actually. That was solely what it was. And you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. And my friend went and stayed with these guys and in the shelters. And I remember looking at them thinking, I'm not sure what that would protect a person against, you know? You'd have to live there like, you know, if you had a direct hit, I don't know, 25 years. And even then, are you sure? Like, is that air really going to stay fresh down there? And it didn't. It's a funny idea.
Well, yeah. It's like building it's like an essential, you know, I never thought about that. It's kind of like putting a fluffy, cushy liner in a coffin.
Yeah. mm-hmm.
you'll be dead. You want
what was That there was another, there was a movie with an alien invasion. Cloverfield Lane, 12 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh yeah.
I thought that was great too. Yeah. That was great.
Yeah. Waiting for them to come out. Yeah. It was a wonderful movie. Now, one of the things that exhibits in here is quotes from The Fall of the Anthropocene, which is not a comforting notion to those of us who are anthropic, which is most of us.
Well, the definition of the Anthropocene is when the world's atmosphere, when its terrain, when its future and its geography were altered by humans, when humans were in charge of those things, were the defining point of those things.
Which is, yeah, a recent idea, which is the result of the studies of global warming. Now, one of the things that you write, Plymouth Valley killed with kindness. Lots of handshakes and stores at school drop-off and at the ultramodern ER. Lots of cheerful hellos, police signs, and prayer hands waved by the pedestrians and drivers alike. And I love this description because at one hand, it sounds like, okay. On the other hand, it sounds like, oh no. And there's a lot of that in this book.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. There is. Well, I think there is. It goes probably goes back to your comment about suburbia, which is there's things that are great about suburbia. It's mostly all I've known. There's also things underlying it that other strangers in ways that I think are damaging to all involved. And there's things about suburbia, this conformity that is less since I was growing up, you know, since the 80s, but it's taken on a different role, where conformity back then was you had to look a certain way and you had to act a certain way. I think now it's how much money do you have? Like there's just a little more, much more money worship than there was. It's become a bigger value. And I think, what do you have? What can you show? And I think it's extended into the ways that we raise our children in like, what are their after-school activities? Did they go to space camp? You know, what are their SATs? Well, probably they didn't take an SAT course. What school are they in? What college are they going to? You know, do they know how to ski? They're weird. It's some weird trappings going on. And if you were to walk in, you'd be like, so you like money? And everyone would be like, what are you talking about? We just like skiing. And it's like, I don't know.
When you talk about the suburbs are built upon, you know, something that much less, you know, joyful than they appear. I know that in our old mortgage when we bought our house 3 years ago, the person we bought from had lived there from there for like maybe 30 or 40 years. And so in that mortgage, there was, you know, some red line language which had to be like crossed out that, you know, only whites could live there. And so they had to cross that out and say, you know, it was, you know, blacked out in the mortgage. But I mean, I had never thought about, you know, our, you know, beautiful suburban house was built upon, you know, the graveyard of some really awful laws.
Yeah. I mean, the history of housing in America and its preference for white people has a legacy, you know, and it continues. And it's ugly. It's really ugly.
It's like the H.P. Lovecraft story where,
you know, the house is built on top of a church, and then the church is built on top of a graveyard, and the graveyard is where, you know, they buried, you know, the Satan worshiper.
It's yeah, I mean, like, there's in my last book, Good Neighbors, I was studying the Kitty Genovese story in Queens. For those who don't know, it's a story in the 1970s of this woman who was murdered outside her apartment complex. She screamed and screamed, and the urban legend is that none of her neighbors called the police because New York City was a terrible place, right? But, you know, they've found that to be false. People did call the police repeatedly. The police kind of covered it up and said that no one called them because it was on them. And Kitty Genovese did not die alone. One of the neighbors came out and held her as she died. So, like, but why did the story of Kitty Genovese gain so much traction? Why did people want to believe New York was so bad? And I think it was white flight. And it was this, like, we've got to move to the suburbs because it's violent, because it's criminals, instead of it's like, there's non-whites living here now. And we're terrified, you know? And I think often that's what's happening when people say, you know, it's crime riddled. It's, you know, there's going to be drugs. It's going to be dirty. It's like, is that true? How true is it?
And speaking of drugs and drinking, Plymouth Valley is pretty heavily invested in both. I mean, in this wonderful, you know, ultra perfect suburb and city corporate town, people drink at work. And the wine is applied with psilocybin. So talk about, you know, the import of drugs in lulling this populace into accepting the unacceptable.
Well, so I'm going to do a sad thing now. And my dad was really sick, and he died like 6 months ago. And in the month before that, like, he was like, just like endlessly, like, I've written down more things to tell you, my nuggets of wisdom, like endlessly. He wanted me to, like, he did not want to go without like getting everything he ever thought off his chest in like a good way. And at one point he was like, you know what you have, Sarah, it's your secret weapon. It's your anger. It's like, he's like, you just blow your top sometimes. And I was like, that's true. And he goes, so you can't drink like other people. You can't, don't drink the way that other people do, because it'll lull your anger, and then you won't have your weapon anymore. It'll be gone. And I think that's true. I think when you have passions, outsized passions, or even passions that might affect your environment, the best way to destroy them is alcohol. And it's so I think in Plymouth Valley, it's so prevalent because it quiets any kind of voices inside their minds saying, like, well, and it's also, if you drink with people, you're bonding with them. You're saying that they're your friends, and you can't turn on your friends. You can't say, I don't like where this collective group is going anymore. I have an objection, because you're getting drunk with them.
And you know, one of the things I really like is that this company town celebrates these kind of like really pagan and frighteningly pagan holidays in regular, you know, succession, and they get, you know, scarier and scarier as the book goes on. So talk about designing, you know, using kind of pagan holidays to create a company tradition.
Oh, that was fun. That was really fun. So I had these, well, you know what? I kind of I love Hunger Games. I don't know if you've read The Hunger Games, but I love The Hunger Games. And there's all these trials in it. And I was like, I love this idea of structuring a book around trials. Like, you know what's coming next as a reader. You're like, how's it going to happen? And then you know, like, there's going to be an ending, right? Because there's trials. So I have these events that are within the hollow religion. And there's the Beltane, and it's like the celebration of spring. And then there's Samhain, which is the day after Halloween. And then there's Thanksgiving. And then there's the Plymouth Valley Winter Festival. And there's all these things and events that come with these festivals that everyone in town has to go, and it's bonding, and it's, everyone keeps saying it's just for fun, but it's like, what else happens at these? What's really going on? So that was just, I loved that. And I loved being able to get, have these moments of pressure on the characters that sort of made new things come out with each trial.
And there was one of my favorite characters was the fellow who's the Beltane King. Who just like, you know, there are always people like that. So, talk about creating this character. And you have a lot of fun with him. And I think, again, this is this kind of knife edge you wield so well, which is things are both funny and scary at the same time.
Well, I think that's often the case. Like, the Beltane King is kind of creepy. And like, my friends and I, if we got together and we saw the Beltane King, we would just make endless jokes. Like, we'd be laughing until we were crying. But then if you were alone in a room with the Beltane King, you'd be horrified, you know? And it's just, like, why are you laughing about it? Maybe you're laughing to make it less scary.
And there's also, too, a couple scenes, and I realized that you had been doing this throughout the book, where people are looking at things and saying, is that the thing it appears to be, or is that just a copy of the thing it appears to be? Like, as if you're surrounded by a reality where everything's, you know, a kind of hat, where everything in that reality has imposter syndrome. And like, is that a bottle of sparkling water, or is that just a copy of a bottle of sparkling water?
Well, yeah. I mean, because I think so much a lot of the story is about being gaslit, and it's not just about being gaslit because of a gender, it's being gaslit, a global gaslight, about the way we think and what's real and what's not real. And so often when you begin to pull at the strings of something, when you think, but this isn't right, you get blocked. And it's like, I'll never know. I guess I'll never know. I can't get the answer to this. And so the fun of the book was saying, like, well, we are going to know. We're going to go to the very end, and we're going to find out exactly what this is. I feel like that's wish fulfillment. You know, am I being gaslit? Well, let's find out. Let's find out exactly what happened. But I also think in life right now, I have this, like, I so much information is coming at me from so many different sources in so many different ways that I have trouble distinguishing where it came from. Was it true? Who told it to me? And I think there's an exhausting way that it prevents a person from investigating. I think it actually paralyzes us. It's even more, it's worse than a gaslight. It's a flood of what's true, what's not. I give up. And so I wanted to point to that a little bit of, you know, a person saying, you know, was there a war going on in the Middle East? And everyone being like, well, I don't know. Well, I think it's just didn't that happen a few years ago? Probably not now.
And I think that that's a really interesting perception, the idea that no matter what you're told, you ultimately question it. And so to talk about, too, about, you know, using that as a pacing tool in a novel of suspense. I mean, this book is the kind of thing you read in one sitting as much as you can, because you just want to find out what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh, man, my life is like that.
I think that the best thing, there's two things that I really wanted to do with this book. And the one was to answer the question I've been wrestling with. Like, my last book was like, I'd like to show you all where I think we're at and, yeah. And the ways we might be able to do better. And this book is like, we know that. We know where we're at. How do we do better? How, like, what are the, in a world where any movement or change seems impossible, where we didn't even know where to start, where do we start? And the other thing I wanted to think about was, so what is the truth? You know, if there is all this gaslighting, wouldn't it be wonderful to tell a story where I'm talking about an individual, a woman in a marriage as a mother, because there's a lot that goes on in that story. And then in the society she's chosen to live in the suburbia, and then in the greater world as an American in that context, what are the stories we tell ourselves to get through the day? And what are the stories that we could jettison? You know, we don't need to hold on to anymore.
You know, one of the greatest losses that this conversation just made me think of it, of the 20th century, is the idea of consensus reality. We used to already be pretty easy to agree what was really happening. You looked at ABC, NBC, CBS News, and you know, they might have slightly different perspectives, but they all told the same thing. You know, here's, I'd come home from school and you'd see pictures of the Vietnam War and go, okay, well, this is the way things are. And that is no longer the case. It's all, you know, we now live in a choose your adventure world. And the damage that's doing is quite apparent. And one of the things this book makes really clear is, you know, the importance of understanding at baseline what the facts are, because the facts are ultimately what will matter when you make your decision and the kind of decisions you make that you have to live with.
Yeah. I mean, it's a surprise to me, too, the way that reality has fractured and our understanding of facts have fractured. And I think that's a lot of the story, too, which is the wish fulfillment of this story is this is what happened. Like, you have all these perceptions, but here's the truth of it. I mean, it would be nice if there were some regulation. Like, everything's a deep fake at this point.
Well, you know, the one of the things too is that the characters in the story have you do a good job at showing how the characters make realistic decisions. You know, the husband just wants to keep working. He wants to succeed. This seems like a realistic and understandable decision. You know, Linda, his wife, is kind of naturally making her way up. But there's comes a point when she like hits the downfall. And one of the things I loved was, you know, the party scene in this book is really both, you know, terrifying on the level emotionally, but also terrifying, you know, a kind of a physical terror too of what can happen. But I think, you know, the emotional heft of that book, of that, is really interesting. Talk about, you know, creating a surreal situation that has realistic emotional heft.
I think everyone, Linda's plight is actually pretty universal. When you do something that other people don't want you to do, and you kind of had to do it. And Mansfield Park is one of my favorite books. And so is, it's that Edith Wharton that's like Lily Bart. I forget, but it's that one. And they are both characters who are like Lily Bart is, she's, got to marry somebody, and she's beautiful, and she comes from aristocracy, and she could, and she's just like, I don't like him. I don't want to. And she ends up ruined. And then there's Mansfield Park, which is, this orphan who's taken in by rich people, and she's proposed to, and they're like, you have to marry this guy. And she's like, no. And then they throw her out, you know, she's got to move back with her parents, and it's creepy. And it's like it's just bad. And the paper costs money. She can't write. And the guy follows her and is like, please marry me. And she's like, okay. And then she's like, I changed my mind. He's like, why? And she's like, I just can't, I can't, I can't, I can't. And I think some people, that I'm like this, you just hit something and it's like, I want to help you. I want to do what you want. I want life to be easier. I can't. There's something that just violates my existence to do what you want. And I think Linda hits the wall and she's like, hey, listen, got it. Know what you want. Like you, wish we could stay friends. Can't do it. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know. And she walks into this party and it's like, everyone knows and no one's saying, and they're trying to get her back in line. And they're trying to socially shame her without ever saying a word to do what they want. And it's so painful to be on that other side of that as like a Lily Bart in life, who's just like, I know what's happening. There's nothing I can do. Like, I can't change who I am. I don't even know that I could fake it, you know, and pretend to go along. Like, there's this one line later in the book where this character, this nutty character, like, cooks up a plot that's totally cockamamie. And Linda's like, I don't think I have this in me. Like, like, listen, I'd like to help you, but I don't think I'm a good detective. I don't think I'm good at lying. I don't think I'm good at any of these things you want me to do. And I think, you know, there's just, it's her character that's really fun, where it's like, I think if you're on board with Linda, you get it, where you're just like, she couldn't help it. Like, she just...
What? That's one of the things that I think is really enjoyable about the book, is that we see a character who is first, you know, that really externalizes the kind of frustrations we all feel, and allows us to experience those frustrations and resolve them with Linda in ways that we, you know, probably can't in our own. We can't tell. There are people in our own lives who we can't tell where to go and how to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely. I remember one time, like, this offer came in, like, for me, for work. And I was like, Dad, what do you think? Like, it was an amazing offer. And he goes, you can't stand people telling you what to do. think it's a good offer for you. And he was completely right. I was like, yeah.
One of the most fun aspects of this book are the genetically engineered birds you create, the Caladrius. Where did you get this idea? It's like a dodo with sharp teeth.
So, I had a stuffy made.
Oh, wow.
How fun is that?
That is great.
It's like, so in the story, they're the town mascot, and they were genetically engineered as a source of meat that was cleaner than chicken. You know, it weighed less waste, and it didn't need to eat as much. But they found that while it was all those things, the air in Plymouth Valley is really, really clean. And the Caladrius can't survive outside Plymouth Valley for that reason. So it's just indigenous to Plymouth Valley. And they keep the animals. And then they're like, well, let's make this part of, you know, a fun part of our town. So everyone has a shelter outside their house, just like you might with a chicken coop. Only Caladrius are weirdos, and they don't like other Caladrius. They'll fight. So they just like one in every house, and they lay eggs. And then as they, you know, as their population rise, sometimes they'll like rove around the town, and then you can't run them over. And you have to like, you have to take good care of them because that's part of the town, but then you can eat them on certain holidays. So that was all like, I was just learning the rules as I went with them, but I originally thought of it because of NBC's Peacock. And then, because a peacock is fun and it's proud. And then I wanted it to be something wilder and maybe more carnivorous, something that bites the hand that feeds and is sort of maybe emblematic of the people of the town, you know, reflective of them. So I kept thinking, and I was looking up mythological creatures, and I found the Caladrius, which is a creature that was supposed to eat the sins or sickness of kings, like a sin eater, and then fly up and burn the sickness away. But sometimes it would turn away from the king and not eat his sickness, condemning him to death. And I, you know, I like that idea. And then I was like, did they discover it? Was it underground in the shelter? So I had that for a while, but then I thought, you know, the easiest thing to do is not have it be that, have it be this genetically engineered creature.
Are we going to see this as a Netflix series? It seems like something you could just keep going with, too.
I would love it. I would completely love it. I'll ask my film agent where it's at.
Sounds great. I have been speaking with Sarah Langan. Her new novel is A Better World. We better hope not for that better world. Thank you for joining me, Sarah.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.